Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including an alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Hello and welcome to The Katie Helper Show. So excited to be here with you. We have a great show for you today. Before we get started, I just want to remind everyone in here, please like the show. Just give it a thumbs up. That's a very easy way for you to support this show. Help us beat back the corporate overlords who try to control our lives and deaths. Maybe that's a little dramatic, but definitely our lives. And you can also, if you're up for it, why not just share this stream? That would be great. Remember to hit like, share, and subscribe. And to subscribe, you just hit subscribe and then you hit the bell. You can, of course, become Patreon supporters at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. And you'll have for this week, we already released a great interview with Breonna Joy Gray, where she talks about a lot of really interesting things, including how the left should interact with the right, whether they should interact with the right, how they should try to convert certain people, not convert others. And of course, she does indeed respond to Cenk Uygur calling her a fake leftist. I also invite you all to come to the call-in that we're doing after the stream. I'll be talking about what we talk about on this episode with our wonderful guests who we're bringing on shortly, Derek Davison. We'll also be talking about what happened on the episode with Breonna Joy Gray, and I'll be probably venting and kvetching about some online trolls. I think those are all the announcements, right? Call-in. Call-in's a free app. The link to that is in the description. I think we can just get started with the show. I'm pretty excited to bring in our guest. He is the co-host of the American Prestige podcast, which is an excellent podcast that I highly recommend. He began his journalistic career by covering the 2014 Ukraine crisis and the 2015 Iran nuclear deal talks for Lo Blog, where he later served as editor. Around that time, he started a blog that eventually evolved into the Substack newsletter Foreign Exchanges. As I said, he is the co-host of the American Prestige podcast with other friend of the show, Daniel Bessner. And he has degrees in Middle East studies and Near Eastern languages and civilizations from the University of Chicago. So welcome on to the virtual stage, Derek Davison.
Hey, Katie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thanks so much for coming. So this is interesting. Did you think in 2014, when you were studying the Ukraine crisis, that it would come to this in 2022?
I wish I could say I had that much foresight, but I probably would have been playing the stock market or something if I could predict that far
right.
in advance.
Yeah.
No, I thought things were going to stay even. I mean, I will cop to even like up to the point of the invasion. I was sort of incredulous that it would come to this. I really thought that things would stay perpetually the way they were with Russia sort of, you know, controlling, annexing Crimea. You know, it's not recognized, but they've done it. And sort of, you know, having the Donbass region and the separatists to play around with to keep Ukraine kind of in a state of instability. I figured they would be satisfied with that.
And what was it that caught your attention in the first place with the Ukraine crisis of 2014?
Well, I mean, part of it was I was, you know, just out of grad school and, you know, looking for something to write about that I could do as a freelancer, as a brand new freelancer. And that happened around that time. So it was just kind of my, you know, something I could cover. But it's, I mean, there's a lot of facets to the conflict. I mean, sort of, you know, you roll up the kind of, you know, the breakup of the Soviet Union and the ongoing aftermath of that, this, you know, very ancient history, you know, between the Ukrainian and Russian, you know, the various kind of Slavic peoples that I thought was interesting. I mean, none of that. You get into like very reductive thinking when you go down that road. But at the time, I thought that was kind of interesting, just the like kind of splintering apart of these people that had historically been linked quite a bit.
As someone who has studied this, what do you think the media misses or does not inform people about that's relevant to the conflict we're now seeing? Like, what's the historical background you think is missing from our conversations?
I mean, I think that in general, the eight years of kind of back and forth along the front line, shelling occasionally, you know, you had shooting across the front line in the Donbass, this like frozen conflict. I think the media, like for most of that time, just basically ignored it unless there was some kind of major, you know, artillery barrage on a given day and, you know, enough people got killed that it was worth kind of covering. But I feel like, I mean, you know, and some of this is hindsight, but it had the media covered that situation as less like, okay, they've you know, reached a ceasefire, we can forget about that, and it had gone more, you know, day to day kind of covering what was going on in this place on both sides of the front line, you know, what the Ukrainian military was doing to people living in the separatist area, what the separatists were doing to people on the Ukrainian side of the front line. I feel like what happened early this year, now the invasion may have still been a surprise, but I feel like for many people, the fact that there is this kind of tense situation around this region came almost as a surprise. Like, oh wait, that's still going on. Like, I feel like there were some balls dropped there along the way.
And where are we now? How would you describe the moment that we're in right now in terms of Russia, Ukraine? I mean, I was almost going to say like the whole world, which sounds kind of ridiculous, but in terms of the sanctions, you know, there is an article in Bloomberg that was called "Corporate Self-Sanctioning of Russia Has U.S. Fearing Economic Blowback." And the article read, "Russia's invasion of Ukraine galvanized the U.S., U.K. and European Union to unleash a slew of sanctions meant to punish Vladimir Putin's government and pressure him to pull his forces back. But some Biden administration officials are now privately expressing concern that rather than dissuading the Kremlin as intended, the penalties are instead exacerbating inflation, worsening food insecurity, and punishing ordinary Russians more than Putin or his allies." So what's happening there? And who could have seen that coming, by the way?
Yeah, I mean, only anybody who's paid attention to U.S. sanctions in Iran and North Korea and Venezuela. Nobody could have foreseen this. I think when you get into questions of sanctions efficacy, you have to ask why they were imposed in the first place. And there's always like the public reason and then, you know, the reasons that nobody wants to talk about publicly. The sanctions were imposed in response to the invasion, and they were characterized as retaliation for the invasion, meaning essentially, you know, we want to hurt the Russian economy so much that Vladimir Putin has no choice but to turn around and pull his soldiers out. Nobody who's witnessed the way the United States has used sanctions and the effect that they've had around the world over the last even 20 years could have thought that it would work out that way, because that's not how sanctions, I mean, they're clearly sanctions have never been effective on that short a time frame in changing the behavior of the target country. Now, if you take a much longer term approach here and suggest that, you know, maybe these sanctions were imposed not for the immediate reason or the immediate cause of trying to get Russia to rethink its actions, but to isolate the Russian economy and cut it off and do what has been done to Iran, again, North Korea, Venezuela, these other places, Syria increasingly, to do the same thing to Russia, then, you know, it starts to make some sense. And that's really what the Bloomberg piece is talking about. I mean, it's collective punishment. It's collective kind of imposed sanctions and then forget it. We just kind of go on our daily lives while the people in the target country suffer. But that's the point. The goal is, who knows, maybe just to leave these things in place in perpetuity. And maybe it's some kind of nebulous regime change, which, again, has never happened. I mean, nobody could look at U.S. sanctions and say that that's a realistic goal. I feel like, you know, it's sort of what's the word I'm looking for? It's disingenuous for the Biden administration or for people in the Biden administration to say, gosh, this isn't working the way we thought it was going to. Like, how did they think it was going to work? There's only the one model to go on, really.
It's a kind of scary combination, I think, when having that, seeing how harmful the sanctions are, of course, not to the alleged targets of the sanctions. But that combined with the fact that it looks like the United States is very interested in prolonging this war. Reading another headline, this one is from the New York Times. The U.S. says it won't pressure Ukraine to negotiate an end to the war. The United States will not pressure Ukraine into negotiating a ceasefire, even as Russia grinds out steady gains on the ground in the country's embattled east, a top Pentagon official said on Tuesday. We're not going to tell the Ukrainians how to negotiate, what to negotiate, and when to negotiate, said Colonel H. Cal, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. They're going to set those terms for themselves. So all of a sudden, the United States is shifting gears and becoming a country that likes to empower other countries to take their, to take their destiny into their own hands and, you know, self-determination and sovereignty and all these things. What's your take on that statement? Besides how funny it is.
I mean, I laugh because, I mean, I wonder if the Ukrainians, you know, announce tomorrow that they're, you know, an intense late stage negotiations on a ceasefire that would leave Russia, you know, more or less where it is now. I wonder if the U.S. would be so supportive of a deal like that. I suspect not. I suspect that this is, you know, we're not going to pressure the Ukrainians as long as their approach to negotiations kind of mirrors what the United States wants to get out of this war, which is a long term. I mean, people have said it, a long term weakening of Russia, the isolation of Russia. You know, maybe, you know, getting rid of Putin, which, again, is not a realistic goal, but is something people have hinted around about. You know, I suspect that if the Ukrainians suddenly got off that page, then you would not see this kind of, we're fully supportive of whatever they want to do. That attitude would change quickly.
And of course, Boris Johnson went to visit Zelensky, right? And kind of discouraged him from brokering a peace deal with Putin.
Yeah, Boris has been there a couple of times, and I think he's delivered the same message both times, not to negotiate a peace deal. This last time was right after Macron and Olaf Scholz and Mario Draghi and I think the Klaus Johannes from Romania went. And it was sort of like, it was weird, like the dynamic of that trip was like Boris just showed up to say, hey, I'm here too. Like, you know, here I am. I'm going to Ukraine too. It's become sort of this like, really, I don't even know how to describe it. It's like a rite of passage almost for European leaders now to like pop off to Ukraine and show up in Kyiv and shake Volodymyr Zelensky's hand and like play that as a backdrop for their domestic political audience, which strikes me as somewhat gross, but that seems to be what it is now.
And what about the way the U.S. is arming Ukraine? Can you comment on that? How sustainable a model is that?
I think it's fairly sustainable, and they've allocated, I think, almost $50 billion in presidential drawdown authority, which is the money that Biden goes to when he makes these announcements that we're sending, you know, another $1 billion or another $500 million or whatever weapons to Ukraine. So he's got a ways to go to max that out, so he can continue this for a while. And of course, it's all good news to defense contractors who get to, you know, make new weapons either to send directly to Ukraine or to replace the ones that the U.S. sends to Ukraine. So, I mean, this is a model that benefits a lot of people who have fingers on important buttons in D.C. I don't think they'll run out of interest in continuing that.
It seems like people are increasingly making it clear that this is a proxy war. Some people are no longer even pretending that it's not a proxy war. Obviously, people who are critical of this war have been calling it a proxy war. You know, my co-host on Useful Idiots, Aaron Mate, has been saying that. He's kind of been ringing the bell, sounding the alarms on that. But now you see people who are pro-intervention who are saying that this is a proxy war. And I wanted us to watch one video clip. Brad, if we could play this one video clip. A friend of show, well, he doesn't know he's a friend of the show, and he's never been on the show, but I'd love to have him on the show. Max Boot, he's actually been on the show in that I've played clips of him. But Max Boot, who is a, how would you describe him? A neocon?
Yeah, a neocon, even, you know, he may even go beyond that a bit. But I describe him as, I think at some point his brain dissolved and that hat that he has on in his drawing there replaced it.
That's a charitable way of describing whatever his condition is. So he had something interesting to say on Morning Joe. Again, this is a guy who, there's a great clip that I've played in the past of Max Boot and Steve Cohen, the late scholar of Russian history, Steve Cohen, where Max Boot fully tries to just McCarthyite him, neo-McCarthyite him, old school McCarthyite him. And Stephen Cohen just is in so elegantly and eloquently kind of shames him for doing what he's doing. Have you seen that clip, by the way?
I haven't, no.
This, okay, maybe I'll look for it later because it's really...
I'm allergic to Morning Joe, I think, but...
Oh, yeah. No, this is the one I'm talking about now. Sorry, that was from Anderson Cooper.
Oh, okay. All right.
But this is a great clip that we have from Morning Joe, which Brad's going to play for us.
Absolutely essential. And I think the key here is we have to understand that we're making a mistake in the way that we think about the war because we keep thinking about it as their war. The Ukrainians are fighting. We need to think about it as our war. Putin is waging war on the West. He is trying to destroy the rules-based international order that we Americans, we Europeans, we all stand for this. This is a direct threat to all of us, and we need to understand this is not a foreign aid project. This is not charity. This is self-defense. This is the front line of freedom right here in the Donbass. The Ukrainians are fighting and dying for all of us. We need to step up, and to echo what Ed Luce was saying, it is unacceptable that right now the Ukrainians are being outgunned 10 to 1 in artillery, 10 to 1. They are losing over 100 soldiers a day. The United States has not seen those kinds of losses since World War II. The Ukrainians are willing to fight. They are willing to die. They are defending their land. They are standing up to one of the most evil dictators in the world, but they don't have the weapons they need to get the job done. They have just enough to prevent a Russian victory, but they don't have enough to defeat the Russians, to win for Ukraine. And that is unacceptable. All of us need to step up. The Europeans in particular, as Joe suggested, because they are doing less than we are. But we need to step up, too. We're not providing Gray Eagle drones that the Ukrainians need. We're not providing as many multiple launch rocket systems as they need. All of us collectively can be and should be doing more because we need to understand this is our fight that the Ukrainians are on the front lines of.
So
hard to know where to begin there.
Yeah, up to you. I'll follow your lead.
I mean, you know, everything there's pretty much wrong on one level or another. This is not a war against the West. Ukraine is not in NATO. There is no vital U.S. interest in Ukraine or in protecting Ukraine. This is our involvement is a choice. It's a conscious choice. I think Max is missing Afghanistan, which he characterized, you know, around the time of the U.S. withdrawal as the permanent frontier war. It should be treated as such, you know, from like the 19th century frontier wars, and the United States should stay there indefinitely. Now he's found a new cause, lucky for him, I guess, to replace that conflict. But the argument here that there's some vital interest in defending the rules-based order. I mean, if the United States wants to defend the rules-based order, it should start by actually abiding by the rules. Like we never abide by the rules. We didn't in Iraq, we didn't in Afghanistan, we didn't, you know, we don't when we impose these massive, you know, humanitarian risking, life-threatening sanctions on countries just because they don't sort of toe the line. It's ridiculous to talk about the rules-based order. It's ridiculous to talk about any rules-based order that the U.S. is supposedly the architect of. And this is a big part of the reason why, by the way, You talk about, you know, the Biden administration having to do, you know, extra diplomacy to try to get countries in the Middle East and in Africa, even sort of, you know, Latin America and parts of Asia on board with this, you know, whole program of sanctioning Russia. Part of the reason for that is that the people in these countries see the hypocrisy of talking about defending a rules-based order where the United States gets to break all the rules, but everybody else has to sort of abide by them. The last thing I'll say, and I sort of, you know, like losing my train of thought because I can't remember everything that he said there. But this talk of like sending more advanced weapon systems, this is really, we're on a slippery slope. We're already on that slippery slope. We started sending the multiple launch rocket systems. We've only sent a few so far, but the demand, the calls to send more are only going to grow. And I suspect that you know, the United States, the Biden administration, the military industrial complex will all be on board with that. But you start to get into things like advanced drones and more kind of more sophisticated hardware. These are things that may not be able to survive the environment that we would be sending them into. There was just a piece, I think, I don't know if it was in the Times, it was somewhere today, I sort of brushed past it, that, you know, Ukrainian military officials aren't sure that they want Gray Eagle drones because they're so close to they're fighting so close to the Russian border and so close to Russian air defense systems. It's not clear they would even be that effective. But you just keep calling for more and more and more and more. And that's how you, that's how you wind up creating a bigger quagmire and meshing the United States even deeper into this conflict.
Yeah, and I mean, his argument, I was waiting for him to compare Putin to Hitler because that's a favorite argument of certain people. Like we saw Michael McFaul make that argument. I mean, people have even argued that it was almost like comedic. A couple of people in one weekend were saying how at least Hitler didn't XYZ. They were actually positioning Putin right. as worse than Hitler.
Right.
Putin didn't do that in this particular instance. But this idea that this over-vilification of Putin as on a kind of civilization-based mission, eliminationist, or people are throwing around the word genocide, do you think that they believe this stuff, or are they just saying this because they want to scare people into supporting the U.S. proxy war?
I think that some of the language that gets used, genocide in particular, is misguided. It's meant to shock people. It's, you know, sort of meant to get to kind of dig at people's emotions and feelings. I mean, Putin, for all I know, may think of himself as on some kind of a great civilizational quest. I don't, you know, there's been a lot of like armchair psychoanalyzing going on with respect to Putin and even like medical diagnosis. You know, there've been these videos of him, you know, looking puffy or whatever, and that, you know, sends us into a 2-day thing about what is he dying of. And you know, I mean, that's all kind of nonsense on some level. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's possible that, you know, he's an older guy. I don't know if he's unwell or not. It doesn't, you know, but either way, he's sort of, you know, got fewer years ahead of him than behind him. Maybe he's thinking in terms of, like, I don't want to be the guy who lost Ukraine or something like that. That could be possible. But I think to throw around overheated terms like, you know, this is some kind of civilizational struggle for survival or genocide is really meant more to play at people's sympathies than an actual attempt to analyze what's going on.
Someone in the chat asked this question, what is this rules-based order? Derek, please explain rules-based order. What are they? Who set them?
Well, the United States set them, and we don't really talk about what they are because we just know when somebody's violated them. I mean, that's essentially what this is. It's a rhetorical phrase. It's meant to signify the instantiation of the unipolar world that existed, let's say, in the 1990s when the United States was unquestionably the global superpower. But, you know, every action the United States has taken since the end of the Cold War on the world stage, or almost every action, has shown that, you know, we don't think there are any rules. We don't abide by any rules. We do what we want because we are a military power and economic power, you know, increasingly or decreasingly so, the latter, I guess. But, you know, it's a rhetorical tool. It's not meant to be a meaningful kind of phrase, like there's a list of rules somewhere that we're trying to uphold.
What is the cost on other countries? Like, what is the fallout going to be of these sanctions on other countries? What's going to happen to everywhere from like Europe to Africa?
Right. So, I mean, we're already seeing some of the fallout of the war, which is sort of the invasion plus the sanctions and the effect that they've had, that's had on food exports. You know, the Russians have stopped exporting much of their food, although they've made some exceptions, I think, for Central Asia. Ukraine has been unable to export food. And these are two breadbasket countries. They export a lot of grain. They export a lot of cooking oil. And so you're seeing, countries that are food importers, that tend to be food importers, like Egypt, Sudan, Lebanon. This has been a big concern in Lebanon and elsewhere in Africa and parts of the Middle East, Yemen, for example. You know, this is really impacting humanitarian efforts there. The shortages of and the consequent rise in price of basic commodities is a huge blow for these places. In terms of Europe, I mean, I think the big impact is in terms of energy, and that'll come primarily in the form of natural gas. Now, Europe, the EU has already imposed an embargo on most of the Russian oil that it was importing. They'll have to figure out how to, find new sources or alternative energy, to replace that oil. But Europe is far more dependent on Russia for natural gas. And we've seen just over the last week or two, the Russians cutting gas shipments to Europe substantially. I mean, cutting off entire countries, cutting, shipments to Germany by half or more. And that's really going to hurt Europe as winter approaches. And there have been moves to, try to impose conservation measures, to find alternative suppliers. The alternative energy, the kind of green alternative energy option is always seems to be last on the list because it's the most complicated and would require the most infrastructure investment.
God forbid we save the world.
Yeah, right. I mean, God forbid you take this opportunity to do something good for the planet. Absolutely. So that's going to be a big blow to Europe. And we haven't even seen, I think, the worst of that, which will come if these gas supplies aren't somehow replaced by wintertime and people are trying to heat their homes and being told, sorry, we don't have enough gas for that.
I wanted to share with you an upcoming conference in case you want to attend it. It's called Decolonizing Russia.
Ooh, sounds fun.
I know. Okay, so here we go. It's called Decolonizing Russia, a Moral and Strategic Imperative. It's taking place Thursday, June 23rd at 10 a.m. You can register. It's the Commission on Security and Cooperation in Europe, also known as the Helsinki Commission. They announced the following online briefing. So this is something that the Helsinki Commission is putting together. It goes a little something like this. Russia's barbaric war on Ukraine, and before that on Syria, Libya, Georgia, and Chechnya. Okay, Russia, I didn't realize, had a war on Syria or Libya, has exposed the Russian Federation's viciously imperial character to the entire world. Its aggression also is catalyzing a long overdue conversation about Russia's interior empire, given Moscow's dominion over many indigenous non-Russian nations and the brutal extent to which the Kremlin has taken to suppress their national self-expression and self-determination. Serious and controversial discussions are now underway about reckoning with Russia's fundamental imperialism and the need to, quote, decolonize, end quote, Russia for it to become a viable stakeholder in European security and stability. As the successor to the Soviet Union, which cloaked its colonial agenda in anti-imperial and anti-capitalist nomenclature, Russia has yet to attract appropriate scrutiny for its consistent and oftentimes brutal imperial tendencies. Then they list the participants, which include Casey Michael, who's part of the Hudson Institute, Casey Michelle, I believe.
Always a good place. Yeah, always a good place. To
always
go for
good place. Experts. They don't like to list that, but that's where he's where he's at. He's the author of American Kleptocracy, Hannah Hopkins, co-chair Democracy in Action Conference, former member of the Ukrainian Parliament, Erica Murat, associate professor, College of International Security Affairs, National Defense University, Butakaz Kasyambekova, lecturer, University of Basel, and Fatima Tliz, Circassian journalist. So what are your thoughts on that? Anything in here you'd like to unpack?
I mean, you're right to wonder about the barbaric Russian war on Syria, given that Russia was invited by the Syrian government to intervene. The barbaric Russian war on Libya is also iffy to me, given that they were invited. It's Wagner Group, I guess, Wagner Group mercenaries, but they were brought in by one of the two Libyan governments, and really, you know, the one that had a working parliament. So, you know, arguably in both of those cases, they were asked to come in by the legitimate government of those countries. I'd like to know if we're doing decolonization everywhere, because I could think of some places that have been colonized more recently than Russia supposedly colonized all these non-Russian peoples. So maybe we could start with like first in first or last in first out and work our way back. I don't know.
Yeah.
That might be a good idea.
Good start. What do they say? You're like supposed to clean up your own side of the street.
Yeah, that's another thing, I guess, that you could say about this. Like, take care of your own colonization before you go worrying about somebody else's.
Decolonize yourself first. But I think this is interesting, the woke language.
Oh, the capture, like the leftist rhetoric is fascinating. Yeah.
It's also funny because as if when they say Russia has yet to attract appropriate scrutiny for its consistent, oftentimes brutal imperial tendencies, that's like all the rage, I feel like. That's what everyone is doing. It's very orientalizing also.
It seems like there's been a fair amount of scrutiny. I will say that.
Yeah. But maybe we can go to the conference.
I'm sure it looks great. I mean,
yeah.
Great panel. Should be a scintillating discussion.
Yeah. It's funny. Someone in the chat actually said, Ukraine asked for American help. I guess they aren't legitimate, though. So that person's being sarcastic. But how do we kind of grapple with that? Yes, there are people in countries who are asking for help. What do you think the criteria should be for whether or not the United States? I mean, I was going to say helps, but I would put helps in quotes because from my point of view, I don't actually think that it's ultimately helping Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I try to look at this on a broader scope and in terms of like you're always going to have cases where you can make the argument that the empire serves a good purpose. Like we're serving a good purpose. This is a worthy cause. These are, worthy people defending their country from, and we should help them. But if you look at the systems that you're fueling by doing that, and this is the way the assistance, the U.S. assistance has gone here is particularly acute, I think, because it's mostly in the form of buying weapons and sending weapons, and that results in funneling billions of dollars to defense contractors who then turn around and lobby in D.C. for a $800 billion a year military budget, $900 billion a year military budget. We're going to be at a trillion in a couple of years. And you just perpetuate this system that views every problem as a military problem that has only one solution, which is always a military solution, whether it's directly or, through things like training and weapons. I feel like at some point that has to be you have to just pull the plug on it. And even if that means, this particular cause or that particular cause, gosh, couldn't we make an exception here or there? I that just keeps the system going to me. And it's, I think the bigger picture is important here.
I mean, especially because it seems clear that the real motives for the United States, I mean, spoiler alert, are not humanitarian ones, are not about saving the lives of Ukrainians, because if it were, they would be much more involved in negotiations and diplomacy. So I think that I don't really believe, I guess I'm agreeing with you, and I don't believe that the United States can kind of just accidentally, while doing things in the interest of empire, help people. I don't think it works that way.
Yeah, it's almost never the case. I mean, I don't want to say never because I'll think of some counterexample, an hour from now, but almost never the case that you get to a good place through, using the empire in this way. I would say on the question of peace talks, at this point, you know, I agree with letting the Ukrainians take the lead and negotiating their own settlement. What I wonder is, as I said earlier, when the Ukrainians are prepared to do that, is the United States still going to let them take the lead? Are we going to be willing to peel off these sanctions if that's the price of, you know, supporting Ukraine in negotiating a peace deal? And I question that. And it's, I mean, it's obviously speculation. We don't know until it actually happens. But I question whether there's going to be a willingness to really put the sanctions on the table and say, look, you know, if this is what it takes for you to negotiate the peace deal that you want, then we will abide by that. I doubt it, but, you know, we'll see.
Rev. Edmund Balea says, this conference reminds me Dr. Mearsheimer is right. Nations are self-serving entities with aspirations to empire.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much, Claude Belodo, for your generous donation, your super sticker. Thank you for that. Sparky says, Ukraine's much better off under Russia than NATO. So wanted to ask you about some other parts of the world. We just had historic elections in Colombia, where a leftist won for the first time. We also had an election in France. And then we're having something interesting happening in Israel. So you can start with everyone you want to start talking about.
I mean, we could start in Colombia with the election of Gustavo Petro, which was somewhat surprising to me. I mean, he won the first round.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. To hear the rest of that discussion, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper, Nick Palm. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.
Craving the coffee flavor you love, but without the caffeine? Kachava's got you covered with their newest coffee flavor. This all-in-one nutrition shake delivers bold, authentic flavor crafted from premium decaffeinated Brazilian beans. Quality nutrition shouldn't be complicated. Just 2 scoops of Kachava's all-in-one nutrition shake and you've got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Whether you're craving that coffee taste to kickstart your morning ritual or as a nutrient-packed reward to round out your afternoon, Kachava keeps you fueled and satisfied wherever your day takes you. Plus, it actually tastes delicious. No fillers, no nonsense. Just the good stuff your body craves. And for the times you feel like switching it up, you've got 7 flavors to choose from, all with the highest quality ingredients. Treat yourself to the flavor and nutrition your body craves. Go to kachava.com and use code NEWS. New customers get 15% off their first order. That's KACHAVA.com, code NEWS.